In this trial, we have laid out a pattern of abuse of power by Governor Rod Blagojevich that culminated in his arrest on December 9, 2008. The governor was arrested for 5 separate criminal acts, all of which demonstrate that every decision this governor made was based on one of 3 criteria: his legal situation, his personal situation, and his political situation. During this trial, we've explained all of these acts, largely through the governor's own words. But they were more than just words. They were actions. They were directives to act, and they were acknowledgments of wrongdoing. We're going to take you through each one of these acts and then demonstrate that this pattern of abuse of power spanned, in fact, throughout the governor's entire tenure in office. First, I'd like to talk about the Senate seat. The governor's own words demonstrated, time and time again, that he saw his ability to appoint a U.S. senator as a golden goose, as a bargaining chip to be leveraged for his own personal and political well-being. 31 conversations intercepted by the federal government and related in the affidavit of Daniel Kane. 31 conversations in which the governor made it crystal clear that he was trying to trade that Senate seat for something of value to himself. How did the governor himself characterize his power to appoint a United States senator? "It's an effing valuable thing. You just don't give it away for nothing." The governor wanted to make a trade. What was he asking? Well, he started high. He wanted a cabinet-level position in the Obama administration if he appointed the person who he thought the president-elect wanted: Secretary of Health and Human Services, an ambassadorship, a lucrative job for his wife, paid corporate board positions for his wife. And why was he entitled to these things? Because the Senate seat is a valuable thing. You just don't give it away for nothing. Then his options began to dwindle. What did he later end up considering? A position with Change to Win, an organization composed of several unions that promote union interests. A 501c4 political lobbying organization that he hoped the president would help fund through his friends. And if nothing else, if none of those could work out, he talked about appointing himself. Why? Because you don't give it away for nothing. Now, the governor has been saying that this was just harmless chatter, that this was just political talk. The evidence shows that the governor repeatedly directed subordinates to act, telling people to go negotiate on his behalf. What did he say to these people when he sent them on their way? He said, "You should assume everybody's listening. The whole world is listening. Don't put it in writing. I would do it in person. I wouldn't do it on the phone." Who says those words except somebody who has something to hide, something to cover up? The governor would say that there are people out there surrounding this issue, public individuals, who are claiming that they weren't approached or they did not have inappropriate conversations. But ladies and gentlemen, as we said in our opening statement, as we've maintained throughout this case, that's not our case. We don't know what the governor's subordinates did when they were given their directives. We don't know if they tried and failed. We don't know if they didn't try at all because they had second thoughts about the legality of what they were doing. We don't know if the governor's arrest interrupted their plans. We don't know. What we do know is what the governor said, captured over and over again by the federal government, showing that he put his own interests first and foremost, directed other people to act, and knew beyond any doubt that what he was doing was wrongful. 31 different conversations when the governor thought no one was listening. 31 wrongful acts. Easily a pattern of abuse of power all by itself. Let's talk about the Tribune Company. The evidence clearly showed that the governor attempted to put a price tag on the provision of financial assistance to the Tribune Company. And what was that price tag? He wanted some editorial board members at the Chicago Tribune fired. 15 conversations with John Harris over a one-month period. 15 conversations in which the governor repeatedly directs Harris to talk to high-ranking members of the Tribune Company. 15 conversations in which the governor makes it clear the message he wants delivered. No money from the state unless those editorial board members are fired. The governor was secretly recorded directing John Harris to tell a Tribune official, "Everything is lined up, but before we go to the next level, we need to have a discussion about what you guys are going to do about that newspaper." Harris replies back, "I won't be so direct." And the governor says, "Yeah, you know what you got to say." Repeatedly, the governor follows up with John Harris. Repeatedly, Harris reports back that he delivered the directive. More than once, we read the exchange between the governor and Harris. He got the message, right? Right. He got it loud and clear. And ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake, the governor knew that what he was doing was wrongful. He agreed that Harris should not be so direct. He agreed that Harris should deliver the message in person, not on the phone. When Harris described his conversations with the Tribune Company as delicate, very delicate, the governor says, I know. Don't push too hard, but you know what you got to do, right? Now, the governor will say that there are people around the Chicago Tribune or the Tribune Company who would say that they did not have improper conversations. We don't know who those people are or if they're telling the truth. But what we do know from intercepted wiretaps, intercepted oral communications at Friends of Blagojevich, is that the governor repeatedly directed John Harris to reach out to the Tribune, and whether it was true or not, Harris was telling him back, "I've been talking to him. I've delivered the message." The governor's own words. Scheming and plotting to shake down the Tribune Company. Fire your editorial board members if you want $150 million in state aid. 15 different conversations, 15 different examples of abuse, more than enough, all by itself, to constitute a pattern of abuse of power. Let's talk about some of the pay-to-play schemes that we heard about. We learned that the governor wanted to raise $2.5 million by the end of last year, by the end of 2008, before the new ethics bill went into play. That would have obviously curtailed his ability to raise money. And in his haste to raise as much money as he could before that deadline, we learned about three schemes where the governor made the price of an official act a coerced campaign contribution. We heard about pediatric care reimbursements. The governor had promised to release $8 million in children's pediatric care reimbursements. Yet in the same breath that he mentioned that, he talked about getting $50,000 from Hospital Executive One. What did he say? "I'm going to do $8 million for them. I want to get Hospital Executive One for $50." He even contemplated, when he didn't get the contribution right away, breaking his commitment, holding up the money. You recall that long exchange between Deputy Governor A and the governor, ending with the governor asking, "We could pull that back if we needed to. Budgetary concerns, right?" And Deputy Governor A said, "Right." We heard about the tollway project. We learned that the governor announced a $1.8 billion tollway project, and in the same breath, talking to subordinates, said he wanted $500,000 from a particular highway contractor. From his own mouth, the governor's own words. I could have made a larger announcement, but I wanted to see how they performed by the end of the year. If they don't perform, F them. The third pay-to-play scheme involved the horse racing impact fee bill. Ladies and gentlemen, you have on your desks a transcript from the audio tapes from the federal wiretaps. I'm going to ask the secretary now to play these tapes one by one. I'd like to take you through each one and talk to you a little bit about it and break it down for you. Before we get to the first one, obviously these are chronological. The first phone call is from the tapped home phone of Rod Blagojevich. It's on November 13, 2008 at 10:05 a.m. I'll remind you of the evidence in the record that the horse racing impact fee bill has not passed at this point. It's still being lobbied. It didn't pass until the 20th of November. If the secretary could play the first tape, please.
He says Johnny Johnson's good for it.
Okay.
He's going to give you, no, he didn't get it, but he said, I'm good for it. I got to just decide what accounts to get it out of. And Ron's going to talk to you about some sensitivities legislatively tonight when he sees you with regard to timing of all of this.
Right, before the end of the year, though, right?
Oh, yeah. So there was no waffling there. It's just that, we just got to figure it out. And so he'll give you the specific details.
Well, he's going to be there tonight, right?
He's going with you. Basketball game?
Yeah, with
the... He knew it was United Center. Wasn't sure what the venue was, but good.
Okay, so, but clearly before the end of the year, right?
Yeah.
He's down there right now with him lobbying on a bill.
He was with him last night, and he's still down there.
Yeah, they're pushing a bill, so that's probably what he wants to wait on.
Well, whatever. I mean, I think that's probably likely. He didn't get into detail with me.
I'd like to talk to you about this transcript. First of all, on page 2 of the transcript, the second of the two pages, on lines 10 and 11, the governor says he's down there right now with them lobbying on a bill. He's talking about the fact that lobbyist one is lobbying for the horse racing impact fee bill with John Johnston. The governor knows exactly what's going on. He knows that lobbyist one is down there. He knows what they're there for. He knows what their interests are. And then on lines 14 through 16, again, the governor, they're pushing a bill. And then he says, so that's probably what he wants to wait on. That's probably what he wants to wait on. The governor is saying John Johnson doesn't want to pay the contribution until he's sure the bill is actually going to reach the governor's desk. Could you play the second tape, please? I apologize. This second tape takes place on December 3rd, 2008 at 2:21 p.m. This is after the bill has passed. This is from the intercepted cell phone call of Lobbyist One. It's between Lobbyist One and John Johnston.
Hello, John. How are you?
Juan. Good. How are you? Checking in.
I didn't know you called.
Oh, yeah, I left a message earlier today.
Yeah. What, where are you right now?
I'm at the trash.
Can I come see you?
Can you come see me?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll be there probably about 45 minutes.
Okay.
See you.
Now, we're going to take you to the third call, which occurs at 4:11 p.m. on that same day. This is a little under 2 hours later. This is intercepted from Lobbyist One's cellular phone. It's between the governor and Lobbyist One.
Hey, it's Lon.
Hold on.
Is
Rod there? Yeah, they're
both here.
Hold on.
Thanks. Hey, Lon. Hey. So, I'm just leaving there. And I talked to him about his commitment. He goes, and I said, two separate conversations. What about your commitment? He goes, Lon, I have to leave in 2 weeks, and I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks. I know that I have to have this in your hands by the end of those 2 weeks. And I said, look, there's a concern that there's going to be some skittishness if your bill gets signed because of the timeliness of the commitment. He said, absolutely not. I mean, do you want me to put some into next quarter? I said, no. That's not my point. My point is, this has all got to be in now. He goes, I'm hopefully going to have it next week, but you have my commitment. I've always been there. I'm going to be there. And I've got to have it in the next 2 weeks because I'm going out of town.
Good.
And the reason it took so long is that Billy came in and started talking about George Steinbrenner, and not about the bill so much, but just about his illness and all that. And I didn't want to have that conversation in front of Billy.
Yeah, I know. Good job. Hey,
can you stop that, Scott? I'd like to take you to page one of that transcript that we just heard. Lines 9 and 10. This is Lobbyist 1. So I'm just leaving there, and I talked to him about the commitment. Notice there's no context there. The governor requires no explanation from Lobbyist 1 about what there means or who him is. The governor knows exactly where Lobbyist 1 is, exactly what he's doing. Lobbyist 1 talks about there's a concern there's going to be some skittishness if your bill gets signed because of the timeliness of the commitment. This is what Lobbyist 1 said he said to John Johnston. He's telling Johnston they didn't want to sign the bill. They don't want to sign the bill until the contribution is in. And the governor at line 27 responds to that by saying, good. Later in the call, at the very bottom of page one and spilling over to the top of page two, Lobbyist One is apologizing to the governor for why his call seems late. It's later than I think it appears the governor expected it to be. He's explaining that Billy came in, presumably Billy Johnston, I don't know, and started talking about things. And as Lobbyist One puts it on line four, I didn't want to have that conversation in front of Billy. Well, why not? Why didn't Lobbyist One want to have that conversation with John Johnston in front of somebody else? Because it was an improper conversation, that's why. I'd like to play the fourth tape now, and this is the next day, December 4th, at 9:09 a.m. It's between Lobbyist One and the governor, and I'm going to ask the secretary to stop it a couple times and explain some things, make some points out to you, and then when it's over, we'll play the whole thing again without me interrupting.
Hey, Lon.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah. So, one thing I was thinking about last night is that you ought to give, not today, but maybe tomorrow, just give John Johnston a call. And say, you know, calling just to say hello. You know, I'm working on the timing of this thing, but it's going to get done.
Okay.
It's
call tomorrow?
It's a 2-minute conversation.
Yeah, happy to do it.
call him tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Call Johnny Johnson or should I call Ed Harris call him? You want me to call him directly, I will. Whatever's the best thing. I'm just a little bit...
I think it's better if you do it.
Okay.
It's better if you do it just from a pressure point of view.
Yeah, good. I'll call him and say, yeah, and we want to do an event downstate.
I said, right.
We want to do it, and we hope to do this so we can get together and start picking some dates to do a set bill sign.
Okay, let's stop there. At line 3, lobbyist 1, talking about the governor being the one to make the call to John Johnson, says it would be better if you do it from a pressure point of view. What does the governor say in response to that? He says, yeah, good. And then a few lines down, elaborating on what he will say to John Johnston. He says, we hope to do this so we can get together and start picking some dates to do a bill signing. The governor is going to make sure in his conversation with John Johnson about a political contribution that he mentions that bill.
Right.
Okay, so what are the chances, based on my conversation with you yesterday, that this gets done next week?
You know, they're good.
Okay.
I mean,
I'm telling you, he's going to be good for it. I got his faith.
Okay. So.
Okay. So, lobbyist 1X asked the governor, what are the chances that this gets done next week? He's asking, can this bill get signed next week? The governor initially says, you know, they're good. Lobbyist 1 says, okay. And then the governor says, I mean, and he trails off. You heard a pause there. Now, how does lobbyist 1 interpret that pause? He jumps in and says, I'm telling you, he's going to be good for it. I'm telling you, he's going to be good for it. I got in his face. The governor was expressing hesitation about signing the bill before he got the contribution, and lobbyist 1 was making sure the governor understood he will be getting that contribution.
I know. I feel like there's somebody else is holding him back.
No.
I believe it's Chris.
No. No.
Well, what's that, you know, a whole year? You know what I mean? Hey, Lon.
No, I don't think he's been talking to Chris. I don't think he's been talking to Chris.
Okay.
Hey!
Now, before we play that again, I want to make one more point. At the bottom of page 2, the line 28, the governor says, what took, you know, a whole year for this contribution? This is not a man who is willingly paying a contribution. This is a man who is being pressured to pay a contribution.
Hey, Lon.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah. So one thing I was thinking about last night is that you ought to give, not today, but maybe tomorrow, just give John Johnson a call and say, you know, call in just to say hello. You know, I'm working on the timing of this thing, but it's going to get done.
Okay.
Call him tomorrow? It's a 2-minute conversation.
Yeah, happy to do it. Call him tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Call Johnny Johnson or should I call Ed Harris call him? You want me to call him directly, I will. Whatever's the best thing. I'm just a little bit...
I think it's better if you do it.
Okay.
It's better if you do it just from a pressure point of view.
Yeah, good. I'll call him and say, yeah, and we want to do an event downstate. I said,
right.
We want to do it, and we hope to do this so we can get together and start picking some dates to do a set bill sign. Right?
Okay, so what are the chances, based on my conversation with you yesterday, that this gets done next week?
You know, they're good.
Okay.
I mean...
I'm telling you, he's going to be good for it. I got his faith.
Okay. So...
Uh,
I know. I feel like there's somebody else is holding him back.
No.
I believe it's Chris.
No. No.
Well, what's you know, a whole year. You know what I mean? Hey, Lon.
No, I don't think he's been talking to Chris. I don't think he's been talking to Chris.
Thank you. So far, we have been talking about the information derived from the federal government's intercepts at the governor's home phone and at Friends of Blagojevich. We have from this information 60 conversations on court-authorized intercepted communications, each one sworn to in this room by Special Agent Daniel Kane. Paragraph by paragraph, swearing that everything in that paragraph is true, swearing that the quotes were accurately written in, swearing that the voice identification of the governor was positive. 60 conversations, all in which the governor places his own interests first, all of which he directs other people to set plots in motion, to use his official powers to personally gain. 60 examples of abuse of power. Is that not a pattern of abuse of power right there? We then heard other pay-to-play schemes earlier in the governor's administration, some of which came to light several years later. We heard about Aliotta. Aliotta admitted in federal court under oath that he bought his position at IFA for two $25,000 campaign contributions. And by the way, he was named executive director of a very important new agency, an agency created to consolidate the bonding authority in this state. But who did he report to? Who did Aliotta report to? Did he report to the governor? No. Did he report to the budget office? No. Did he report to anyone employed by state government? No. Aliotta reported on a weekly basis to Tony Rezko. Let's talk about the Health Facilities Planning Board. The evidence was clear that the governor directed votes on hospital permits. You got your permit approved if you made a political contribution. We heard testimony regarding Mercy Hospital in Crystal Lake. A vote of no on a certificate of need permit suddenly became a vote of yes. Why? Because that hospital gave the governor a political contribution. And this was testimony corroborated by a number of independent witnesses at the Rezko trial, and later, as he began to cooperate, by Tony Rezko himself. Then we heard about Joseph Carey and his plane ride with the governor, about what the governor wanted to do, what plans he had to be governor. What did the governor tell Joseph Carey? That he wanted to balance the budget? That he wanted to improve education? No. He said he intended to use the power of his office, his power to award contracts, to get campaign contributions from those contractors. And why did Joe Carey ultimately plead guilty? Because he told a company that they had to hire a particular consultant company or they wouldn't get state work. Joe Carey admitted to telling that company, in Illinois, the governor and the people around the governor pick the consultants. The governor's abuse of power extended to his disregard of the legislature. You heard testimony that the governor repeatedly directed his staff to intrude upon the legislative powers, on your powers, by ordering his agency to ignore decisions of the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules, JCAR. Now, whether or not you believe that expanding family care is a good idea, and I know a lot of you do, the point is not the ends, but the means. As the Auditor General said yesterday, we are a state and country of laws, and everyone, the governor included, must obey them. And yet he directed the department, by rule, to raise the eligibility level for family care, despite the fact that JCAR rejected that rule. Not once, not twice, but four separate times. He directed the agency to follow not the law on the books, but the law that the governor wanted. But the governor cannot make law. Only you here in the legislature can do that. And if we allow this to happen just because this particular program is a well-intentioned one, then how do we stop a governor when he implements one for an ill-intentioned purpose? We have the Executive Inspector General report. We didn't have a live witness for that. We didn't need a live witness for that. That report couldn't have been clearer. The Governor's Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, GOIA, directed the Illinois Department of Employment Security to manipulate job descriptions to avoid veterans' hiring preferences, told employees to falsify their employment applications. The Executive Inspector General found that the Governor's Office was behind all of these illegal actions and showed, quote, a complete and utter contempt for the law. We heard from the Auditor General, who talked about many things. First, the efficiency initiative. Now, this was something that started out in the General Assembly. It was designed to reduce costs, to streamline governmental services. But when the governor and his staff got a hold of it, it became a tool to subvert the appropriations process and to direct millions of dollars to favored consultants, the largest of which, a $25 million contract, went to a company that didn't even exist at the time. Two senators, during questioning, described this as a money laundering scheme. The flu vaccine procurement. The governor knew that the procurement of vaccine was illegal under federal and state law, but he proceeded anyways. And worse yet, he not only violated federal and state law, but he entered into a contract for $2.6 million in vaccine, knowing that not only that it couldn't be delivered, but that we didn't need it. We already had the vaccine, but he had started down the road and he wasn't going to turn back. The state is still on the hook for that $2.6 million, and based on the other vaccine the Illinois talked about buying for other states, we're lucky that number is not $8.2 million. Then we get to the iSaveRx program, more of the same. Again, the FDA told the governor not once but twice that importing drugs from foreign countries was illegal under both federal and state law. Not because it was a bad idea per se, not because affordable drugs are a bad thing, far from it, but because drugs from foreign countries cannot be determined to be safe, not by the federal government at least. But the governor was undeterred. He implemented the program anyways. The result? No monitoring, no testing of the drugs, no supervision of the foreign pharmacies whatsoever. Exactly the reasons why it's illegal in the first place under federal law, because it's unsafe. But for the governor, splashy press releases were far too valuable to let little details like safety and soundness get in the way. It cannot go unmentioned here, as we talk about whether the governor is fit to serve. It cannot go unmentioned. Other things that we heard on the intercepted federal wiretaps, in which the governor indicated that he no longer wishes to serve. He indicated that several times, in several ways. He was quoted on November 10th. He does not want to be governor for the next 2 years. He referred to remaining in office as governor as having to suck it up for 2 years. He expressed frustration at being stuck as governor. When he was talking to the Chicago Cubs about the IFA financing, he told them they better get that project done by the January meeting of the IFA because, quote, I'm sorry, not quote yet, the governor was, quote, contemplating leaving office in early January 2009. And we know he was contemplating leaving office. Look at the jobs he was trying to get. Secretary of Health and Human Services, ambassador, a job at Change to Win, anything, anything but the office of governor. I'd like to say just a couple of words about the rules of this proceeding, because we've heard so much about it outside this chamber this week. I have said before, and I will say again, that these rules are even-handed and fair. They apply equally to both sides. The governor has spent a lot of time outside this state mischaracterizing these rules. He says that evidence from the House impeachment record cannot be questioned. That is absolutely not true. The governor questioned the evidence in the House, and he can do so here. You members have been questioning and challenging the evidence for the last 3 days. If the governor had watched, he would know that. The prohibition from the United States Attorney's Office. Well, listen, that hampered us as well. Don't you think we would have loved to be able to call the victims of these shakedowns, the hospital executive at Children's Memorial, John Johnston? We were just as hampered as he was. But we told you all along, our case was really not about those subsidiary people. It was about the governor's own words. And in that regard, we called Special Agent Dan Kane, who told you he listened to all those tapes and verified it was the governor's voice and verified that the quotes were accurately transmitted to the affidavit, paragraph by painstaking paragraph. The governor wasn't here to cross-examine him. The governor wasn't here to testify in his own defense, because who has better knowledge about what the governor said than the governor? The governor has called this tribunal a kangaroo court. He's called it a sham. He's claimed the fix is in. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that is not the body that I've been working in front of this week. That's not what I've seen. I have seen a body that has deliberated at length. I have seen a body that has repeatedly challenged us, as you should, on every point. A body that has asked insightful and deliberative questions. I have seen a body that has done honor to this process and honor to the Constitution, and I am proud to have had the opportunity to present in front of you this week. Ladies and gentlemen, we believe that we have more than adequately demonstrated a pattern of abuse of power. We're asking you to judge this governor based on the totality of his actions. Now, I want to be clear, the article of impeachment refers to some or all of the acts. We have 13 paragraphs. It is not our responsibility, our burden. It is not necessary that you be satisfied that all 13 paragraphs have been established. All that you need to be satisfied with individually is that you have found a pattern of abuse, no matter how many different paragraphs that takes. Or as we have suggested in some of these, like the Senate seat, I would argue that's a pattern all by itself with 31 separate acts. From the intercepted conversations, oral and wire communications alone, we have 60 conversations, all related to plots by the governor to use his official acts to further his own personal gain. That, I would suggest, easily shows a pattern of abuse of power all by itself. That's not counting the corruption at the Health Facilities Planning Board. That's not talking about Aliotta's purchase of his position. That's not talking about Joseph Carey and the things that the governor said to Joseph Carey. Combined with that, the governor's clear disregard of the law and legal procedures with regard to JCAR, the Executive Inspector General's report, scathing report on hiring at the Department of Employment Security, and the Holland audits, the pattern of abuse of power is unmistakable. The evidence showed that throughout his tenure as governor, the governor has abused the power of his office and put his own interests above the people's. Which interests? Legal, personal, political. The people of this state deserve so much better. The governor should be removed from office.
the governor present. We're advised that the governor is in the building and will be here shortly. We will stand at ease. Please stay near the chamber because as soon as we're able, we'll take it up again.
Okay, Sean. David Ellis has finished presenting his case. He didn't take advantage of the full hour that he was entitled to. I checked the clock here. He began at about 5 minutes after 10. So the governor is in the building, is my understanding.
The governor is apparently in the building, but not quite ready to enter the chamber. So I think we're going to be at ease for just a few moments here, awaiting for that process to take place. And, of course, the governor will be giving his closing statement, even though this is the first time he's actually appeared at this Senate trial this week. And we will have to wait and see what he's going to tell the senators and for the residents of Illinois. We'll just have to wait and see. Nobody seems to know at this point exactly what will be included in the governor's statements. But to just recap David Ellis's closing argument, he's the House Special Prosecutor. He said that the governor's actions show a pattern of abuse of power, and he went back through the evidence that was presented during this trial, ranging from the governor's ignoring of the legislature to create programs such as importation of drugs from Canada, purchase of flu vaccines, expanding health care programs, all without the legislature's approval, to also going into a bit of the criminal complaint that's been filed against the governor and replaying some of the tapes that were played earlier this week that were intercepted phone calls that included the governor's voice on those in talking about what is alleged to be a scheme to basically shake down a horse racing executive for a campaign contribution in exchange for the governor signing a piece of legislation that's beneficial to the horse racing industry.
David Ellis, this past week in his appearances before the Senate, Sean, has been really kind of a low-key personality, but his presentation, his argument, his closing argument here this morning before the Senate was a lot more animated, a lot more forceful, a lot more, I think, dynamic.
Yeah, I think so too. It was, he did keep, I think, a very professional and but more subdued tone throughout this entire process. But today, he seemed to sum up his arguments and have a little bit more of a forceful delivery to his speech when he gave those closing statements. As you mentioned, he went about 40 minutes going back through that list of evidence against the governor and also replaying those tapes. I'm trying to remember if it was two or three times. He sort of dissected those as he went along, but we got to hear those again. And that, I think, was just another way to hammer home to senators what he felt was some very strong evidence against the governor's own voice.
The governor is reported to have told reporters outside the State House there, Sean, as he was coming in this morning, that he isn't giving up hope and that he plans to keep on fighting. But he wouldn't provide any kind of a hint about what's in the presentation or the speech that he intends to deliver once inside the Senate chamber. All he said was he hopes he gets a fair shot before the 59 state senators.
Yeah, exactly. I think what he's looking to do is, of course, is to come here and I assume what's going to happen today, and this is it's tough to assume what the governor will do at any point, and especially in this circumstance. But I would assume that the governor will try to lay out some of the charges that are against him, especially some of the charges of expanding the programs, expanding health care, things of that nature, and try to point out what he has said on many of the talk shows, and that is that he was basically just trying to help people, that was his goal, and that many of the lawmakers who are are going to decide his fate went along with him in some cases, supporting him along the way. So I'm sure that's going to come out. Now, how personal the governor gets, how it's impacted his family, how this the arrest, the whole Senate impeachment trial here, how that's impacted him personally, he may get into that as well. We don't know. And we've been told, as you said, it's going to be, they say, a very passionate speech by the governor today. But it could very well be the last time that Governor Rod Blagojevich makes a public speech holding the office of governor of Illinois.
Is there anything in the rules that addresses, let's assume for the moment, that the governor goes off point, starts ad-libbing, and as he tended to do, I thought anyway, when he was making the TV media blitz for two or three days in New York, he kept going off point and arguing and pointing to things that had nothing whatsoever to do with the case that David Ellis had laid out, but arguing that, you know, kids' health and things like that were not impeachable offenses, which was really off point. My question is, anything in the rules that would permit either the presiding officer in the Senate, the Chief Justice, or any member of the state Senate, the jury, as it were, to object?
To the governor's statement?
Yes.
From what we've seen, no, that would not be the case. I don't see anything in there. Now, there may be some process in which they could do that, but I really doubt that's going to happen. I think the governor is going to be able to deliver his speech. They'll give him this platform, and that's going to occur. That's what I think is going to happen. We will hear from him whether he takes an entire hour and a half, which he is being allotted. Again, we just don't know at this point, but I think the governor will be given his opportunity to speak. But again, I don't know if it's going to really change anybody's mind in that Senate chamber. From the people we've talked to this morning and even late yesterday, most of them felt that the evidence was overwhelming enough against the governor that no matter what he says, no matter what he does, that the governor is going to be removed from office. And that could come as soon as sometime today if they decide to actually go into voting.
I wonder if he came to Springfield on one of the state airplanes. And would he have a ride going back if he's removed from office?
Well, that has been discussed, and that's an interesting point. Different people have talked about that as well, and what we have understood is that certainly that he did fly down on the state plane, but there has been discussion that he might be heading back to Chicago long before any action by the Senate. Remember, as we talked about at the beginning of the broadcast today, that the way this process will work is that once the closing argument and then, of course, Mr. Ellis having his chance at rebuttal, once that is done, deliberations can begin in the Illinois Senate. By deliberations, these are not closed-door deliberations necessarily. These will be on the floor where each senator will be allowed up to 5 minutes to speak. They will not be asked to vote and not be asked to say whether or not the governor should be removed at that point. What they will be able to do is just make a statement. What we could see before we go to that is a closed-door meeting of some sort where each party will caucus behind closed doors in a private meeting. But that part, the actual statements will be made public. Now, then later on, we will also hear from the Chief Justice, Thomas Fitzgerald, asking each individual lawmaker then if they agree that the article of impeachment and should the governor be removed from office, then they will answer a yes or no. But all of that time, all of that process in between could take quite a bit of time to complete. It could be this evening before anything occurs. And so the governor certainly would have time, if he does not stick around and after his speech decides to leave, certainly would have time to get back home.
Well, we know that the governor certainly is capable of using up his time. He's being allotted 90 minutes in his presentation here today. And, Sean, you know as well as I do that during his first term, during his first two or three appearances before a joint session of the General Assembly, in his first term for what was State of the State or budget message, he frequently talked more than 90 minutes.
Well, that's true, but I would assume today he could be told that his time is up, that he has only so much time allotted to him. That is by Senate rule. That was adopted right at the beginning of this trial. That actually occurred more than 2 weeks ago. So I would assume they will try to stick close to that. And an hour and a half is a long time, of course, for anybody to speak. But you're right. He could certainly, if he decides to, he certainly could push that limit, I believe. What people have to realize too, with the governor coming in, is the governor is still facing criminal charges. We believe he is going to be indicted. That's been pretty evident that that will likely occur sometime this spring in federal court. We have not necessarily seen everything that the federal prosecutor will bring in that indictment. We only know what was in the criminal complaint. There could be more evidence coming. The governor probably has to walk a fine line when it comes to answering some of these charges against him, including what was included in the criminal complaint. So I don't know exactly if the governor is going to go line by line and say, here's the evidence against me, and this is why I should be able to remain in office and you should not remove me. Or will the governor talk more in general terms about being governor and what he has tried to do? This very well, again, could be his final speech as governor. Does he want to go out in some way with his head held high and trying to explain to people what he thinks or what he says he has tried to do as governor, or does he want to go out in some other fashion? And again, we'll just find out when he does begin speaking.
And by way of recapping, we're currently awaiting for the governor to enter the state Senate chamber. House Prosecutor David Ellis began his presentation about 5 minutes after 10 this morning, and then concluded his presentation around 10:45. And, of course, now it's time for the governor to make his closing argument, up to 90 minutes, as we've talked about. The governor is in the state capitol building, and Justice Fitzgerald put the state Senate trial stand at ease until they were able to accommodate the governor and get him into the chamber in advance of his presentation.
And I don't think we'll delay too long here. It could be a few minutes just for the governor to get situated. He did not arrive, or he was not spending the night in Springfield, of course. He was not here bright and early this morning, so we believe he's only been here maybe an hour or more at this point. So the governor, just getting into town, just getting situated, they probably will give him a few minutes to get organized. But again, he has not entered the chamber yet, as we've been told, but we do expect that rather shortly. Governor Rod Blagojevich giving his closing statement here on what is the fourth day of this Senate impeachment trial, but again, the first time that he has appeared at his own impeachment trial.
Pretty dramatic session yesterday, Sean, when Senate President John Cullerton got up and made the first disclosure that the governor was interested in making an appearance before the body. So this morning, when you arrived at work there at the State House, I can imagine that the atmosphere was pretty thick.
Well, yes, and we talked
with
a little
anticipation,
bit.
That is.
Sure, we talked a lot. A lot of reporters talking earlier today about where will this day wind up ranking in state political history? And you have to think it's going to be right there at the top. Maybe not for always the best of reasons, but certainly from a standpoint of what people are talking about and the anticipation, as you mentioned, and really the gravity of this entire process that is taking place. We may have a governor who has been impeached, the first governor to be impeached, giving a public statement before the body that could remove him from office later today. We could have that vote take place. We could have a new governor sworn in before the day is out. And we've been told Pat Quinn is en route to the Illinois Capitol and will be here in case that does take place at some point. So again, you're right, a very historic day, and one that that certainly people not just here in Illinois, not just here in Springfield, are paying attention to. This is getting attention really around the country and maybe even overseas.
Sean, what can you say about what you have witnessed personally or heard from other reporters about state employees there in the state capitol building? Because there's a mix of employees, people who work for the governor's office, people who work for, obviously, the Secretary of State's office, people who work for the state treasurer, who also has an office there in the state capitol. And I think, doesn't the state controller also have an office on the second floor?
Sure.
Of the state capitol. So you've got a mix of all those kinds of state employees. What have you seen or witnessed or heard from some of those employees from December 9th up until today?
Well, I think state employees in general, despite sometimes the knock on people who work for state government, I think for the most part you have people who are putting in their time and doing their business and they keep doing their job. The governor's office sent a letter just a week or two ago, basically thanking those workers for their time and effort. And however, that was received a whole another ball of wax for us to talk about at some point. But really, that's what has gone on. State government has continued to operate. It does impact the ability of what the state can do or needs to do by having a governor who is facing this entire.